dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Our program tonight consists entirely of a speech given earlier this week at the State University of New York in Binghamton by Scott Ritter, former Chief Weapons Inspector and Major in the U.S. Marine Corps. We've played talks by Ritter on this program before, but in this speech he has forcefully illustrated the choice we face in this time as Americans, between empire and freedom. Many people in our communities have relatives or friends in the military, many who have been drawn into the armed forces through what has become a de facto poverty draft. If you have family members in the armed services, I especially urge you to tape tonight's program and put it into the hands of as many service people as you can. Ritter hints at, but stops short of naming, the only effective strategy for stopping the juggernaut of war and empire: the refusal of the American people, military and civilian, to obey the call to war. But there are those who have long walked that path of disobedience. On December 6th, one of the greatest of those, Philip Berrigan, passed from life surrounded by family and friends at their home, Jonah House, in Baltimore. During his nearly 40 years of resistance to war and violence, Berrigan focused on living and working in community as a way to model the nonviolent, sustainable world he was working to create. Jonah House members live simply, pray together, share duties, an attempt to expose the violence of militarism and consumerism. The community was born out of resistance to the Vietnam War, including high-profile draft card burning actions. Later, the focus became ongoing resistance to U.S. nuclear policy, including plowshares actions that aimed to enact Isaiah's biblical prophecy of a disarmed world. Because of these efforts, Berrigan spent about 11 years in prison. He wrote, lectured, and taught extensively, publishing 6 books, including an autobiography, Fighting the Lamb's War. On the day before his death, he dictated the following words to his wife, Liz McAllister: "When I lay dying of cancer, Philip Berrigan, I die in a community including my family, my beloved wife Elizabeth, 3 Dominican nuns, our death plat, Carol Gilbert and Jackie Hudson, jailed in western Colorado, Susan Crane, friends local, national, and even international. They have always been a lifeline to me. I die with a conviction, held since 1968 in Catonsville, that nuclear weapons are the scourge of the earth. To mine for them, manufacture them, deploy them, use them, is a curse against God, the human family, and the earth itself. We have already exploded such weapons in Japan in 1945, and the equivalent of them in Iraq in 1991, in Yugoslavia in 1999, and in Afghanistan in 2001. We left a legacy for other people of deadly radioactive isotopes, a prime counterinsurgency measure. For example, the people of Iraq, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan will be battling cancer, mostly from depleted uranium, for decades. In addition, our nuclear adventurism over 57 years has saturated the planet with nuclear garbage from testing, from explosions in high altitudes, 4 of these, from 103 nuclear power plants, from nuclear weapons factories that can't be cleaned up, and so on. Because of myopic leadership, of greed for possessions, a public chain to corporate media, there has been virtually no response to these realities. Berrigan meant to continue the statement, but was seized with a fit of coughing and died before he could finish. It seems strangely fitting to turn to the voice of a lifelong warrior who has come to see war not as an exercise in glory, but as a sign of humanity's failure. Scott Ritter.
If you would just bear with me, I'd like to say right up the front that please don't view this as a lecture. Who am I to lecture anybody on anything? I'd like to view this more as a dialogue and a discussion. Something I think is an absolute requirement in this thing we called American democracy. And I want to, before I get into the talk about Iraq and the weapons inspections and the looming war with Iraq, I'd like to color it, or at least put it into a broader context of American democracy. You know, what are we as a people? I think that's an important issue. You know, we're going to talk about going to war with Iraq. Why? To defend the United States. Well, what is the United States? What is it we're defending? I can tell you that when I put on the uniform of a Marine Corps officer, wore it proudly for 12 years, I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Notice I didn't say I took an oath to defend the president. I didn't take an oath to defend the vice president, to defend the White House, to defend Congress, to defend the Pentagon. I took an oath to defend a piece of paper, a document that sort of defines who we are as a people, a nation of laws, a nation of ideals. And you know, a democracy. You know, the Constitution is an amazing document. It speaks of we the people of the United States of America. It speaks of government of the people, by the people, for the people. So when we talk about the American government, you know, one of the things I get a little angry at is, well, it's the government's fault. Well, okay, it is the government's fault, but what is the government in the United States? We're the government. We the people of the United States of America. We're the government. It's government of the people, by the people, for the people. We need to start understanding that to make the United States work, to make it function properly, we, the people, have to get involved. That's what democracy is all about, the involvement of the people. And for a democracy to function, you know, the people do have to get involved. They have to go in and invest in this thing we called America, an American democracy. In order for democracy to function well, the people who get involved have to be empowered with information, with knowledge, with facts. And the only way you're going to get that kind of empowerment is to engage in hopefully what we're going to engage here tonight, a discussion, a dialogue, a debate, if you want to call it such. That is the vehicle of democracy. You know, the Constitution gives me the freedom of speech. You may not agree with anything I'm saying, but I have the freedom to stand up here tonight and speak before you. It gives us the freedom of assembly. It gives you the right to come here and listen. It's an amazing thing. But what are we going to do with these freedoms? What are we going to do with these freedoms? You know, we're talking about a nation today, the United States. We exist in a time of war, the war on terror. And there can be no doubt that on September 11, 2001, our nation was attacked. A horrific event took place. 3,000 Americans lost their lives within a span of 100 minutes. So we are at war against those who perpetrated this horrific attack against the United States. Now, we've been told by our government that in the war on terror, it's a black and white issue. You're either with us or you're against us. That means that there's no neutrality. There's no room in the middle. If you're sitting on the fence, if you're neutral, you're not with us. Therefore, you must be against us. If you raise your hand and ask a question, you're not with us, you're against us. We've been told in this war on terror that it's unpatriotic to challenge the government. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you that it's unpatriotic to sit back and keep your mouth quiet in times like this, that the only way we can succeed to survive as a nation is for the people of the United States of America to hold their government accountable for what's being done in their name, plain and simple. Far from being an act of treason, speaking out today is the most patriotic thing one can do as an American citizen. It is the ultimate expression of American patriotism. You know, I put on the uniform to serve my country, to defend the Constitution. And I was willing, and I am willing today, to lay down my life, to give up my life for my country, for you, for the people of the United States. You know, we got over 1 million Americans today who wear the uniform proudly. Wear the uniform of the United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, they wear your uniform. They work for you. They're willing to die for you. That's an amazing thing. Think about it. Right now, as we speak, there's over 1 million Americans who are prepared to give up their lives for you. What are you prepared to do for them? You know, giving up your life in the defense of your country is the ultimate sacrifice. And before we ask someone to go forward and make this ultimate sacrifice, shouldn't we, the people of the United States, ensure that it is a cause worthy of such a sacrifice? And now we're talking about going to war with Iraq. Let's talk about war. The average age of a Marine Corps Lance Corporal who will be going off to fight in this war with Iraq is 20 years old. For the students in there, in the audience who attend, look to your left and right. Look how many of you are out here. What's your age? 19? 20? 21, 22, these are people your age are going to go off into combat. And contrary to what you've seen in the movies and what you've seen on TV, you know, war isn't about banners unfurling, rock and roll music playing in the background, and glory. War is about death and destruction, plain and simple. War is about killing, human beings killing fellow human beings. When I was in the Marines, I took my Marines out to the rifle range several times a year. Teach them to shoot at paper targets from 200, 300, 500 yards. Not because we had a grudge against National Paper, but because I was teaching my Marines to put 5.56 millimeters of copper jacketed steel into a human body. Let's talk about that for a second, you know? It's pretty graphic war. It's a horrible thing. 5.56 millimeters of copper jacketed steel coming at you at 3,000 feet per second. Hits the body, even before it penetrates the skin, the impact alone creates a cavity inside, shredding your organs. This is before it even penetrates the skin, just the impact. And now it penetrates, and it hits a bone and starts to fragment. So the bullet deflects down, and maybe it eviscerates you, just guts you right on the spot. Then hits another bone, comes out the back, usually about the size of a grapefruit, taking your organs out with it. And you're left on the ground bleeding. That's war, ladies and gentlemen. It ain't a video game. You know, it's not Nintendo. When your life force runs out, you don't get to hit reset and come back to life. You're dead. Sometimes you don't die. Sometimes you get shot and you lay there for 12 hours, screaming out your mother's name. Sometimes they sever your spinal cord, and then you get to spend the rest of your life as a paraplegic. Maybe they just blow off your arm, so you get to spend the rest of your life with one arm. Or you step on a landmine and you lose that. You lose your eyes. You lose your hearing. You lose your brain because it's about killing. And you try to spend the rest of your life trying to come to grips with the fact that maybe you wiped out a dozen or so 19-year-old kids. And 10 years from now, wonder, could they have been married? Could they have had children? What are their parents thinking? All you have to do is attend the funeral one time of a 28-year-old man that you knew as a friend, you knew and loved as a friend, and watch a mother shovel dirt on his grave. And watch her soul just be ripped from her body. Watch the sister collapse, inconsolable. Do that one time, it's one time too many. Do it six times and it's a nightmare you'll never forget. And we as a nation are getting ready to go to war where we're going to be burying hundreds, if not thousands, of our fellow American citizens. Why? Why? War is the ultimate expression of the failure of mankind. War is about humans killing humans. We should not willingly go down this path. But again, I'm standing here before you as a Marine, former Marine. I'm not a pacifist. I'm not someone who's rejected war. I hate it. With my soul, I hate it. But I understand that there comes a time when you got to stand up and fight for what you believe in. You know? And sometimes you got to do some pretty unpleasant things, and this might include going to war. Now I want to bring in another topic that I want you to think about. The rule of law. Hate to mention it, but you know, we are a nation of laws. That's why I keep mentioning this inconvenient little document called the Constitution. It defines us as a nation, who we are as a people. It says that we will peacefully coexist under the umbrella of law. It gives us individual rights. It gives us protections. It gives us freedoms. It is law. Article 6 of the Constitution says that when the United States enters into an international agreement or treaty, which has been ratified by 2/3 of the United States Senate, that is the law of the land here in America. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have signed the United Nations Charter. We have said that we want to have a rule of international law that governs how we interact with the rest of the world, how the world interacts with us, how the world interacts with one another. And the United Nations Charter rejects war as a means of solving, resolving problems between nations. But it does say that there may be times when you have to go to war. So what are the conditions under which nations can go to war? A, self-defense. If you're attacked, Article 51 of the United Nations Charter is quite clear on that. If you're attacked, you have the right to defend yourself. Hence, on September 11, 2001, we were attacked. And under the United Nations Charter, and the Security Council of the United Nations has endorsed this, so has the rest of the world, we have the right to defend ourselves. Now, whether or not you agree with how the President of the United States has conducted the war on terror, whether or not you agree how we've gone into Afghanistan, let there be no doubt, we had a right to do so in defense of our country. Self-defense. Now, Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter says that when the international community, through the vehicle of the Security Council, finds that a situation exists that represents a threat to international peace and security, the Security Council can pass a resolution authorizing the use of military force to resolve this situation. Hence, in 1990, after Iraq invaded Kuwait, violating the sovereignty of that nation, the Security Council of the United Nations passed a resolution 678 under Chapter 7 that said that this invasion will not stand, that the international community can form a coalition and militarily evict Iraq from Kuwait. That's the war I fought in. Not a good war. No war is good. But a just war, a legal war. Now we talk about Iraq today. Has Iraq attacked us? Are we acting in self-defense? Does Iraq pose a threat to international peace and security that warrants this kind of action? It's a curious thing. It's a tough one to answer. Has Iraq attacked us? No. That one's clear. Does Iraq pose a threat to international peace and security that warrants military intervention? Well, Iraq did. In 1991, the international community, through the vehicle of the Security Council, passed a resolution under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter that said, so long as Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, so long as they have weapons of mass destruction, they represent a clear and present risk to international peace and security. And they formed a group of inspectors to go into Iraq and oversee the disarmament of Iraq. And it found that, you know, Iraq had to comply. If Iraq didn't comply with its disarmament, it would be a threat that would have to be dealt with militarily. That's where the inspectors came into play, to disarm Iraq. That seems like a pretty black and white situation, isn't it? The international law, the international community says Iraq can't have these weapons, these chemical weapons, these biological weapons, these nuclear weapons, these long-range ballistic missiles, and they've created a group of inspectors to go in and disarm it. Pretty straightforward, but it's not as straightforward as you would think. I need to tell you right off the bat that, you know, weapons inspections, we see it on the TV screen every day right now. For 6 days now, weapons inspectors have been at work in Iraq. For inspections to work, a couple things have to occur. One, the Iraqis have to fully cooperate with their obligations under the rule of law. Iraq must be disarmed. Iraq must fully cooperate and comply with its obligations. Plain and simple, there can be no obstruction. If the Iraqis obstruct, if they fail to comply, inspections cannot work. Two, when you pass a law, You have to be willing to enforce a law. I mean, what good is a law that you pass and you don't enforce? You could pass a speed limit, you know, 45 mile an hour speed limit, have a cop there with a radar gun, people blowing by at 70 miles an hour, and the cop doesn't stop them. What good is the law? No good at all. You have to enforce the law to make the law mean something. So when the Security Council passes a resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, that is law, that is international law. And it says that if Iraq doesn't comply, you must be willing to enforce to compel compliance. So if Iraq fails to comply, you must be willing to go to war to enforce the law. But you also have to understand we're talking about the rule of law. Keep in mind, you know, let's view Iraq as a nation that's been suspected of the crime of possessing weapons of mass destruction. We suspect them of this crime. Now we're investigating this crime, so view the weapons inspectors as cops going in to enforce the law, to implement the law. What happens in a police investigation if the cop does an illegal search and seizure? What happens if he does an illegal wiretap? What happens if he doesn't read them their rights? What happens if he violates the due process of law? The criminal suspect walks every time. Not because the criminal suspect is innocent, but because the police violated the law. They violated the due process. So for inspections to work, the weapons inspectors themselves must adhere to the principles of international law. The weapons inspectors must never deviate from their mandated task of disarmament. Inspectors are in Iraq for one reason and one reason only, and that is to disarm Iraq. Now let's go back to 1991 when they originally passed this resolution sending the inspectors in. I told you it was a pretty black and white situation. Iraq was told to disarm, and the inspectors are going in to disarm Iraq. End of story? Not so fast. Let's put it into a bigger context. And I think this is one that we as Americans better understand, because I'm here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it's our government that's corrupting this process, which means it's we the people who are corrupting this process. This is our fault, what's happening right now. Let me tell you what's happening right now. In August 1990, Saddam Hussein sent his military forces into Kuwait, occupying that country, also occupying a whole bunch of the world's oil production capability. You know, it was amazing, though, when he moved into Kuwait, James Baker, the Secretary of State, then Secretary of State, came out and said, you know, we have to respond militarily because this is about oil. And, of course, immediately he was told to shut up because President Bush, Herbert Walker, number 41, looked out the Oval Office and saw a bunch of demonstrators in Lafayette Park with signs that said, no American blood for oil. You see, ladies and gentlemen, go back in time in history. Those of you who are in college right now, please forgive me, because I have a tendency to say, remember back to 1990. And a lot of people go, I was 8 years old. So bear with me. But for those of you who are my age or older, remember back to 1990. You know, we still had, as a nation, we had this big monkey on our back called Vietnam. You know, today we don't talk about Vietnam. I wish we did. But we don't. We've sort of forgotten about Vietnam. We talk about Desert Storm. We talk about Coast. We talk about Afghanistan. We talk about the military with this sense of pride, as we should. We should be proud of those who wear the uniform. But in 1990, we were worried about Vietnam. You know, from a president's standpoint, sending lots of American soldiers overseas to fight in an unpopular war, that was just not politically the right thing to do. And the American public weren't ready to go to war for oil. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Well, you know, a lot of bad things happen around the world. The Rwandans fight one another. You know, there's genocide, but we don't always intervene. But now Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, and we're going to intervene. Why? Not because we're defending Kuwaiti democracy, because we're defending Kuwaiti oil. But we couldn't say that. We have to have another reason to get the American public involved in this, supporting this war. That's a tough one with Saddam Hussein. Because you go back even further in time and you understand that from 1980 to 1990, the United States had a decade of friendship with Iraq. It's a weird friendship, you know, because Saddam Hussein is a brutal dictator who, commits horrific crimes against humanity. But we were friends with Saddam because there was another power off to the east named Iran that in 1979 was taken over by Islamic fundamentalists, and they took over our embassy in Tehran, kept 50-odd Americans hostage for 444 days, big national shame. And now we have the Ayatollah Khomeini spreading Islamic fundamentalism across the Middle East, threatening the United States. And we viewed Iraq as a bulwark against the expansion of Islamic fundamentalism. So we went to bed with Saddam. We helped him out. He became our friend. He became our ally. Interesting things happened during this time period. You know, Iraq is a nation of around, 20 million people fighting Iran, a nation of around 50 million. Do the math. There's more Iranians than Iraqis. Study the Civil War. What happened when General Lee took on General Grant? Confederacy went up against the Union. Field of battle. Bullets fly. People die. At the end of the day, the Rebs may hold the battlefield. There's 5,000 dead Johnny Rebs. There's 10,000 dead Billy Yank. But the Rebs pull back. They don't have anybody to replace their casualties. The Union, they bring in more troops, build up their army. They meet again in a field of battle. Bullets fly, people die, 5,000 more Johnny Rebs die, 10,000 more Billy Yanks die, but the Rebs can't replace anybody. The Yankees build up their army again. The Union grinds them down. And that's what was going to happen to the Iraqis when they fight the Iranians. The Iranians come at them in human wave assaults. You know, the Iraqis dug in on this field of battle. They dug in, put in their machine guns, put out minefields, put out artillery, and they waited. And suddenly the Iranians come in. They got a bunch of 12 and 13-year-old kids with the key to heaven around their neck. They line up in a human wave, and on they go through the landmines. Boom, 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 boom. Kids dying, doesn't matter. Next wave comes in through the landmines. You keep charging. They fire the machine gun to the barrel mill, so you run out of ammunition, and the kids close in, and you got 5,000 dead Iraqis. And you can't replace them. Didn't mean to scare you. Sorry about that. Saddam Hussein knew he couldn't win that battle, a war of attrition. He would lose. So what did he do? He developed chemical weapons. Chemical weapons to offset the numerical advantage. You see, when you fire chemical weapons against 12 and 13-year-old Iranian children with keys to heaven around their neck, all they know is they're choking to death. They can't breathe. They got to run. They panic. The attack's over. And to say that, today we're sitting there condemning Iraq for using weapons, as we should. It's a violation of the Geneva Accords. But, we had this guy named, what's his name? Donald Rumsfeld. Yeah, he was affiliated with the Reagan administration back then. He used to fly into Baghdad. He met with a guy named Wafiq Samurai, who at that time was the director of the Iranian branch of Iraqi military intelligence. And Wafiq Samurai would sit down with Donald Rumsfeld, sit down with the officials from the Defense Intelligence Agency. As the United States laid out the satellite imagery of the Iranian frontline positions, and the United States would point out where the Iranian tanks were, where their infantry are, and then sit back while the Iranians plotted how they were going to attack, to include using chemical weapons. It's not as though we didn't know they were doing it. We actually encouraged them to do it because we recognized that's what was needed by the Iranians to offset the Iraqis to offset Iranian numerical advantage. Interesting war, that one. If you look at geography, Baghdad's 75 miles from the Iranian-Iraq border. Tehran's 700 kilometers away, 500 miles. They both have Soviet-produced Scud missiles with a range of around 300 kilometers. The Iranians can fire their missiles at will into Baghdad, demoralizing the Iraqi citizenry. The Iraqis can't fire back unless they extended the range of their missiles. So they did. They produced long-range missiles. To do this, they had to get technology from Europe. Technology costs money. Where'd they get the money? American agricultural loans, $4 billion worth a year. We just handed it over to them, knowing they would divert it. We let them build chemical weapons. We let them build long-range ballistic missiles. We let them acquire the technology needed for nuclear weapons. We let them acquire the technology needed for biological weapons. Why? Because Iraq was our strategic ally, and we wanted our strategic ally to be strong enough to withstand the Iranian menace. Then the war ends in 1988. We have to deal with this guy, Saddam Hussein, now. We know he's a dictator. We know he's a bad guy. But we came up with this concept called constructive engagement. You see, if we just diplomatically engage with Saddam, we'll convince him to do the right thing. Well, Saddam Hussein, you just keep paying me money so I can buy more weaponry. So now Saddam invades Kuwait. How do we deal with the fact that this guy was our friend? He invades in August 1990. How do we deal with the fact that in May 1990, a senatorial delegation led by Bob Dole, staunch Republican, went to Iraq, met with Saddam Hussein, and Bob Dole embraced physically Saddam Hussein, called him a true friend of the American people? Now, they've invaded Kuwait, and we've got to respond. How do you tell the American people we're going to go to war against our friend? He stops becoming your friend. Now, you don't want to explain this decade of history, so you basically rewrite history immediately. August and September of 1990, go back and play the videotapes of George Herbert Walker Bush when he talks about that man, Saddam Hussein. He says, Saddam is the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. He is the personification of evil. He is an evil man. This is a crusade, a war between good and evil, the forces of good and evil. And America will rally. We will go forward and we will defeat evil. And the American people bought into that. They went, okay, we got that one, Adolf Hitler. The problem is, when you define somebody as Adolf Hitler, there is no other solution than defeating and removing him. How do you deal with Adolf Hitler? How do you diplomatically engage with Adolf Hitler? How do you resolve this thing through any vehicle other than violent confrontation? From the very beginning in 1990, even before we went to the war, the United States was boxing ourselves into a rhetorical corner that we couldn't get out of. We were defining the problem of Saddam Hussein in harsh black and white terms, good versus evil. You know, I can tell you this, the world ain't black and white. The world's gray, many different shades of gray. And when you define a problem in black and white terms, you've missed, here I am, I'm a simple Marine, I gotta warn you, my grasp of the English language sometimes is tenuous. But you failed to define the problem properly. When you don't define the problem properly, you say black and white, that means you have to have a black and white solution, which means you don't have a sound solution to the problem either. Well, from the very beginning, we defined Iraq and Saddam Hussein in black and white terms, good versus evil. And notice what the president's telling the American public, that we're going to war to do what? To defeat evil, to confront Saddam, to get rid of Saddam. But you know, he invaded Kuwait. What did the international community say? Remember I mentioned to you that resolution, 678. It said that Iraq invaded Kuwait and that invasion won't stand and a coalition could be formed to do what? To liberate Kuwait. That's what international law spoke of, the liberation of Kuwait. Now when Saddam invaded Kuwait, one of the things that occurred was the imposition of economic sanctions, stringent economic sanctions as a means of compelling Iraq into compliance. Well, Iraq chose not to comply. They kept their troops in Kuwait. We went to war, we liberated Kuwait. The war ended, troops come home, victory parades in New York and Washington, D.C. The whole world's declaring victory. Good job, guys. We won, we liberated Kuwait. But the president's got a problem. Because in the back in America, hands are going up saying, excuse me, Mr. President, didn't you say this is a crusade against good versus evil? That's why we went to war? And didn't you define evil as Saddam Hussein? And I'm looking on TV and we got these victory parades in New York City and Washington, D.C., and yet Saddam still resides in Baghdad. Did we win this war? We had a political problem, ladies and gentlemen. Saddam Hussein's continued existence has become a political problem for the presidency. Not a national security issue, mind you. Iraq does not pose a threat to the security of the United States. It is a political problem to the presidency, because the presidency has defined the situation in unrealistic terms, black and white terms, good versus evil terms, and now he doesn't have an appropriate solution to deal with it. So how's the president going to deal with it? The troops are home, war's over, but you can't let Saddam continue to exist. You have to contain Saddam. How do you do that? Economic sanctions is an effective means, but you know the sanctions were imposed when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and now Kuwait's liberated. Shouldn't you lift the sanctions? Wouldn't you think that would be the logical thing to do? Well, it would be, except the United States now is going to find an excuse to continue the sanctions, to contain Saddam. What is the excuse? Weapons of mass destruction. We take the issue of weapons of mass destruction, we take it to the Security Council, and we say, look, as long as Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, they represent a threat to international peace and security. We sort of ignored the fact that we helped them get these weapons to begin with. Forget about that. As long as he has them, he's a threat to international security. We don't talk about Iran's weapons of mass destruction. We don't talk about Israel's weapons of mass destruction. It's only Iraq. And we single them out. We have to get rid of these weapons. Why? Well, because it provides an appropriate way of containing Saddam through economic sanctions until we get rid of Saddam. You see, after the Gulf War, even though the troops are gone, the internal assessment in the White House was that Saddam Hussein couldn't last more than 6 months. 6 months after his defeat in the fields of battle in Kuwait, 6 months after his economy was shattered, 6 months after his nation was destroyed by bombing, the United States said, Saddam will be gone. Finished. History. Now, we always felt that the solution would be applied by a general. We call it the 75-cent solution. Some Sunni general will come up, pull a pistol. 75 cents is the price of one 9mm bullet applied to the side of Saddam's head, pull the trigger, Saddam's gone. But now we have to create an environment that helps facilitate this kind of solution. Containment through economic sanctions. Kuwait's liberated. You need a new link for sanctions? Weapons of mass destruction. Economic sanctions will be continued until Iraq complies with its obligation to disarm. Okay, fair enough. So now the inspectors go in. But understand what's happening here. The inspectors go in under international law that says Iraq's weapons of mass destruction must be eliminated. And if the weapons are eliminated, economic sanctions are lifted. You will not find a single reference in a Security Council resolution to regime change, to removing Saddam Hussein from power. It simply doesn't exist. But think what the United States wants. It's all about regime change. You see, the policy of the United States has been from the very beginning to eliminate Saddam Hussein. Plain and simple. And we use the inspection process to facilitate this by linking economic sanctions to the inspector's work. That is a corruption of the process, ladies and gentlemen. And let me highlight to you how that corruption works. Because 6 months later, after the inspectors went, Saddam's still there. He's still alive. The United States has a problem. How do we deal with Saddam? Well, you can't let the inspections work. Why? Because if the inspections work, what happens if the inspectors come back and say, we got all the weapons? You got to lift the sanctions. And if you lift the sanctions, you've broken containment. And if you've broken containment, Iraq comes back into the fold of the international community with Saddam Hussein still at the helm, which is, of course, the last thing we can have as our policy of regime removal. Inspections are only useful to the United States insofar as they facilitate regime removal. In 1991, then Secretary of State James Baker said that even if Iraq complies with its obligation to disarm, economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. It's a total deviation from international law. We have rewritten international law. In fact, we just destroyed the legitimacy of the entire inspection program. Because we're saying it doesn't matter if Iraq cooperates, it doesn't matter if Iraq obeys the law. We're still going to punish them with the death penalty. There's no international law that supports that. From the very beginning, in 1991, the United States corrupted the integrity of the process. Now, silly us, the inspectors, we just thought we were there to disarm Iraq. And we tried. We tried really hard. Remember I told you, for inspections to work, the Iraqis have to comply. They have to cooperate. Well, the key to the inspections working was Iraq's providing a declaration listing the totality of their holdings of weapons of mass destruction. They had to provide this declaration. Information is the fuel that drives the inspection engine. And the key, the source of this fuel was from Iraq. Iraq would supply this declaration. You know, we'd get the declaration. We go into Iraq, hey, 15 bombs. We go up, count them, 1, 2, 3, 15, blow them up, check them off, let's move on. 4 machine tools, 1, 2, 3, 4, blow them up, let's move on. That's how it's supposed to work, a gentleman's agreement, a very simple process. What happens if the Iraqis lie, though? Submit a false declaration. What happens, as they did, when they submit a declaration that lists less than 50% of their chemical weapons holdings, less than 50% of their ballistic missile capabilities, refuses to acknowledge having a biological weapons program. Of course, their nuclear program was peaceful, peaceful civilian nuclear program, no military nuclear program whatsoever. Suddenly, the inspectors don't have all the information they need to do their job. To do inspections, it's a scientific and technical job. If you want to go after chemical weapons, I think you need to have a chemist. If you want to go after biological weapons, a biologist would be useful. Nuclear weapons, yeah, that nuclear physicist has a role to play. And believe me, if you want to go after ballistic missiles, you need a rocket scientist. There is a role in the world for rocket scientists. If you check my resume, I'll guarantee one thing. You won't find any of those titles after my name. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a nuclear physicist. I'm damn sure not a rocket scientist. There are no rockets in the Marine Corps, I can tell you that. But what I am is an intelligence officer. I'm a spy. My job is to gather information. I was brought into the picture once Iraq lied, once Iraq submitted a false declaration. My job was to acquire data. Now, I said spy. Spy is short for espionage. Espionage implies that there is a set of laws that are being violated. You see, when I worked in the former Soviet Union, not that I spied, but if I had, you know, I would have been breaking Soviet law. If they had a secret out there that my government told me to get, and I went out and I got it, if I got caught, I'm a criminal. I'm a spy. I'm arrested. I'm violating the laws. But when it comes to Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, Iraq has no sovereignty on that issue. Iraq's not allowed to have these weapons. They're not allowed to maintain this information. So as an inspector, if Iraq has chosen to lie and hold on to this data, we're allowed to use whatever means necessary to gain access to this information. That's not spying. That's inspections by another means. That's why I was brought in, to inspect Iraq with another means. You know, they're lying. Our job is to disarm. It's tough to do it when the Iraqis lie. You know, I told you, you have to be willing, the Iraqis have to fully cooperate, and the Iraqis have to be held accountable for failing to comply with the law. Plain and simple. Well, as early as June 1991, we recognized right off the bat that the Iraqis weren't doing that. I'll give you a little story. Inspectors went into Iraq, nuclear inspectors, and they received a tip-off from the United States government that there was a facility in western Baghdad where there were trucks, about 100 trucks with material on the back. The inspectors went to the site, surrounded the site, and looked over the wall, and there they were, the trucks, material, we got them. Go up to the front gate. Hey, we're here to inspect. Here's our warrant. Open the door. Let us in. The Iraqis went, this is an AK-47. You're not moving anywhere. And I tell you who won that fight. It wasn't the inspectors. Yeah, inspectors don't carry guns. We go in armed with the mandate given to us by the Security Council. Iraq has said they will comply. Therefore, when the inspectors say, open the gate for inspectors to work, the gate must be opened right then. And it wasn't. The gate was shut. And an Iraqi with a gun stopped the inspectors. Now, the inspectors were shocked. They called back to New York. Hello, diplomats. Yes, we're at the site. Yes, yep, the trucks are there. They won't open the gate. Well, I know they're supposed to open the gate, but they're not going to open the gate. What do you want us to do? Ask again. Okay, could you guys open the gate? No? All right. You know, the diplomats in New York were astounded. What do you mean they're not opening the gate? They have to. They agreed. The deal is you show up, the gate opens, we inspect. The Iraqis weren't opening the gates, so the diplomats sent the inspectors back to the hotel while they conferred. The diplomats called the Iraqi government authorities and said, hey, we had some boys go out to a facility. You wouldn't open the gate. You're supposed to. And the Iraqis went, you know, you're right. Big misunderstanding. We really apologize for it. Send them out tomorrow. So the next day, the inspectors go out to the facility, surround it. Oh, yeah, well, there's no more trucks. But the gate's open. And that soldier's saying, come on in. They go, where are the trucks? And they go, what trucks? Well, the ones that were here yesterday, the ones that made these tire tracks. No, I'm sorry, there were never any trucks. It was a very hot day, you hallucinated. And I'm serious, this is an excuse the Iraqis came up with. So the inspectors called up New York and said, hey, we're in the facility. Great, no trucks. What? What do you mean no trucks? They were there the other day. Yeah, but they've left. Well, they can't do that. Well, they did it. So the diplomats sent the inspectors back to the hotel. The United States takes another satellite picture. The trucks have moved 60 kilometers further to the west. So the inspectors go out 2 days later and surround the facility. But this time they've learned their lesson. They send one inspector up a tower. He gets up there with a camera and starts taking pictures of the trucks in the facility. The Iraqis sit there, bam, bam, shoot at him twice. Inspector's down, but he's got some pictures. The Iraqis panic. They open up the back gate and out the trucks pour, getting onto a highway trying to skedaddle out of there. But the inspectors jump in their vehicles and race off after the convoy, riding up along next side and taking close-up photographs of the contents of the trucks until the Iraqis pull off, load a gun, bam, 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 shoot the rounds, the inspectors stop. But now they had the photographs that proved Iraq was lying. You see, the photographs revealed equipment used in an enrichment program for an Iraqi nuclear weapon. Iraq had lied. Iraq had failed to comply. Iraq had physically obstructed the work of the inspectors. Iraq had physically threatened the safety of weapons inspectors. Inspections cannot succeed in this fashion. You may call what happened there a success. I call it a failure, because the way it's supposed to work is the inspectors show up, knock on the door opens, and they do their job. That's the only way inspections can work. For inspectors to get involved in this game of cat and mouse and hide and seek where they put their lives at risk, that is not an inspection. That is a very dangerous situation. What did the Security Council do when confronted with the reality that Iraq was lying? Well, they had a meeting. Diplomats love meetings. They got back together and they said, all right, we have to convince the Iraqis we're really, really serious this time. Let's pass a new resolution. It says, Iraq, we're really, really serious this time. If you cheat, there will be serious consequences, and you have to tell the truth. Submit a new declaration that lists everything. Well, what did the Iraqis learn from this experience? That they can cheat, they can obstruct, and they're going to get away with it. The same thing a criminal learns when the cops aren't willing to enforce the law. Inspections can't work unless there's an enforcement mechanism. And from the very beginning in 1991, the enforcement mechanism was not in play. So inspections were doomed to fail from the very beginning, which is okay from the American standpoint, you see, because as long as inspections fail, Iraq's not in compliance, which means economic sanctions stay in place, which means you contain Saddam Hussein. Mission successful. Well, again, the silly inspectors, we weren't willing to play that game. Our job was to disarm Iraq. Now, I have to tell you right off the bat, when I say inspection, every inspection was different. There's no such thing as, you know, an inspection. Each one was different. And I asked you to consider the Iraqi as criminal suspects and the inspectors as cops going in and doing the investigation. Sometimes we'd go into Iraq to do an interrogation. Sometimes you go into Iraq to do a technical survey of a site. Sometimes you go into Iraq as a paramilitary commando type raid looking for hidden material. Each inspection was different. And before we'd even set foot in Iraq, we'd spend 2 to 6 months worth of preparation, intelligence groundwork, gathering the data needed to do the inspection. It's a very difficult job. And Iraq made it even more difficult by not complying. But I'm going to give you a little piece of data. By 1996, the inspectors, through hard work and tenacity, were able to ascertain that Iraq had been fundamentally disarmed, that we had accounted for 90 to 95% of the weapons of mass destruction that Iraq had, including 100% of the factories used by Iraq to produce these weapons, together with their associated production equipment. That's pretty good. Now, I can hear the question. I think over there I heard it. 100% of what, Mr. Ritter? You know, you just told us the Iraqis lied to you. They submitted a false declaration. So 90 to 95% of what? What's your baseline? 100% of what? What if the Iraqis lied? And we know they did. What if there's 10% you don't know about? So it's 90 to 95% of 110%? What's the basis of this? Well, I have to tell you that we never accepted anything the Iraqis said at face value. They lied to us. We had tremendous success. You know, let's talk about interviews. You know, we'd go into Iraq to interview people. Set up, bring a scientist together. The beauty thing about an interview, and you hear a lot about interviews today, the need to get Iraqi scientists out of the country with their families so they cooperate. I'm here to tell you right now, I spent 7 years in Iraq interviewing Iraqi scientists. I didn't need to get them out of the country to get them to cooperate. You know, a liar is a liar, plain and simple. And the difficult thing about a lie is you got to remember what lie you told. It's not the truth. So you sit down with the Iraqi scientist, say, okay, tell me your name. Gotcha. How long you worked at this factory? Gotcha. Did you do any traveling? Boom. Start asking the questions. And he starts telling a story. You dismiss him, bring in his friend, ask the same questions. Bring in another person, ask 5 guys the same question. Then you bring the first guy back in, ask him the questions over here. You start seeing deviations here. You start noticing these. And then you dismiss the scientist after, say, a week of nonstop questioning. And you go to Germany, a nation they visited. And you go into the Germans and you get the immigration records. You find out when the guy arrived in Germany, who he visited. You go visit the places he visited. Talk to the guys he did business with. Find out if he signed any contracts. Get a bill of lading. Get a letter of credit. Get an invoice. If the Germans don't cooperate, the German police come in and make them cooperate. And you gather documentary evidence. Then you go back to Iraq and you bring that scientist in. You go, hey, just want to go over this story one more time. Now, you say you only got 2 machines of the type we're interested in, right? I swear, Mr. Ritter, only 2. I remember it as if it were yesterday. And you bring in the other guys and they say the same thing. Only 2, only 2. Then you bring them all together and say, okay, so we're all agreed, only 2, yes. All right, excuse me, one thing. It's sort of like, you know, that Columbo moment. You pull out the document and you go, well, how do you explain this this invoice here? That is your signature down there, isn't it? That is the date. Yeah, it says you got 12. They look at the document and say, how'd you get that? You say, none of your business. Just answer my question. How'd you, where, you said 2, right? But it says 12. Oh yeah, those machines. I forgot all about those. Yeah, and now they have to take you to where the machines are. That's how we disarmed Iraq, not by trusting them, but by investigating them. You know, we put a lot of pressure on them. Sometimes, you know, the system worked. Ballistic missiles, we put a lot of pressure on the Iraqis in the field of ballistic missiles. We knew they were lying. In 1992, they finally had to admit they were lying. They said they held on to 98 missiles, six launchers they hadn't declared. They say, come into Iraq and we'll show you where they're at. So we go into Iraq, we go to a field, we expect to see 98 missiles and there's nothing there. We say, excuse me, Mr. Iraqi, where are the missiles? They say, well, we blew them up and we buried them under the ground. So now we have to become forensic archaeologists. We come in with the bulldozers and we dig up the earth. We pick up the missile parts and we have to start collecting serial number after serial number after serial number off the individual parts. And we build a big catalog of this data and we go to the former Soviet Union, to the factory that produced these missiles. And we say, give us the production logs. And they give us the production logs. And we start matching serial number with a missile and a missile with a shipment to a delivery. And we were able eventually to ascertain or confirm 96 of 98 missiles. That's pretty good. 96 of 98. Now we have a bunch of scrap metal over here we think is probably the other two missiles. But you know, the Iraqis lied to us, so we can't give it to them. Our standard for verification is very high. But we did a good job in the missiles. Chemical weapons, you know, weapons of mass destruction, contrary to what Donald Rumsfeld says, aren't produced by magic. There is a confluence of science, technology, and industry. You need a facility to produce these things. And the rules of science and technology take over. Take, for instance, sarin and tabun, two nerve agents produced by Iraq. They have a shelf life of 5 years. That's it. And then they're no good. We blew up the factory in 1991, 1992. So any weapons they might have been hiding from us aren't any good now. They no longer have a viability. But there is a nerve agent that does, called VX. If you produce stabilized VX, VX is one of the most dangerous things in the world. If you produce it in a stabilized fashion, it can still kill you decades from now. Now, the Iraqis in their declaration said they didn't have a VX program, but we didn't believe them. We didn't believe them because they're known liars. And we had this one investigator, Case Walterbeck from the Netherlands, who always used to go to the factory, Mathana State Establishment, and stare wistfully at this one building that he was certain where the VX program was. It was an empty building, though. The Iraqis had cleaned it out. And he'd look at the building and stare at it. Then he'd get on with his job. And after several months of doing this, he was looking at it one day, and the Iraqi counterpart came up and said, Mr. Walterbeck, what are you doing? He said, I think that's where you had your VX program. The Iraqi looked at the building, looked at Walterbeck, and said, no, no, Mr. Walterbeck. We never had a VX weapons program there. We had it over here. And he pointed to a building that had taken a 2,000-pound bomb during the war, collapsing the roof. And the beauty of that one, though, is that's a snapshot in history. We now know exactly what was going on in Iraq on January 20th, 1991, if we can get into that building. So once again, the title forensic archaeologist comes into play. We go in, we lift the roof off, the inspectors crawl in and grab the documents and the material. And you know what they found? A research and development program for VX nerve agent. Now we turn to the Iraqis and we say, you never declared this. And the Iraqis say, hey, time out. That declaration was due in May 1991. You blew up this factory in January 1991. When we made the declaration, we didn't have a VX program. It was destroyed. So we're not lying to you. I said, all right, that's pretty clever. but we started going through the documents, and we said, how much VX did you produce? It was small, 30 liters. But we found a document that said 300 liters. Said, hey, excuse me, 300 liters. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, 300 liters, we did produce it, sorry. But, you know, it doesn't matter because it wasn't stabilized. Well, we said, that's fine. Just show us where you disposed this material. So they took us to a field, and we did a core sample of the field. We tested the material, weighed it out. They had disposed of VX, there's no doubt about it. We said, well, how did you bring this stuff in here? You know, they showed us a metal tank. We went up to the metal tank. The inside had been cleaned out with Clorox. There's nothing there. But there's a little purge valve on the end. One of our inspectors takes a swab, sticks it up there, gets liquid, puts it in a plastic bag, takes it back to the laboratory. Stabilized VX. The Iraqis lied to us again. We said, hey, what's going on here, guys? You produce stabilized VX. The Iraqis went, yeah, but we never put it in a weapon. So we went to the destruction pit where they blew up the weapons. We grabbed up the fragments, scraped it, took it to a laboratory, found stabilized VX on the fragments. They put it in a weapon. Craig said, but everything's destroyed. We never had any intention to produce large amounts of VX. It was just a research and development program until 1997, when we find 22 crates of special production equipment the Iraqis have been shuttling around the country, dedicated for VX production, so we blow it up. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you, where do we stand on VX? The Iraqis lied to us. They said they didn't have a program. We found a research and development program. It's destroyed. We found out the research and development program had in fact been a pilot production plant that produced significant quantities of VX, but it was destroyed. The VX produced, destroyed. They lied about stabilizing it. We now know they did, but the weapons they put them in, destroyed. They lied about not wanting a large-scale production. We found that production equipment, but we destroyed it. Is there a VX production program in Iraq today? I don't know, but I do know this. From 1994 to 1998, we had weapons inspectors in the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure, and we never once, and these inspectors used cameras, sensors, no-notice inspections, the most intrusive inspection program in the history of arms control. We never once detected retained VX or retained prohibited capability of any nature, or efforts by Iraq to reconstitute. Weapons inspections were successful, but I can't tell you how successful, because the Iraqis lied. Biological weapons. They said they didn't have any biological weapons. Okay, but we thought they did. Al-Hakam State Establishment, we were convinced that that was used to produce anthrax. The Iraqis said, no, it's producing single-cell protein for animal feed. Well, you can produce single-cell protein for animal feed, we know that, but usually it's done in pretty rudimentary setups. This was very expensive equipment. This was the most expensive single-cell protein in the history of animal feed, if in fact that's what it was used for. Well, we were able to compel the Iraqis again through the process of interrogation and gathering intelligence to admit by April 1995 that they had a biological weapons program at Al-Hakam. Now, we went to the facility. We said, okay, you lied to us. We got it. How much did you produce? They said 8,000 liters. And we took a look at the factory and said, no way. This thing could have produced 10 times that amount. Give us the logbooks, the production logbooks to document 8,000 liters. They said, we couldn't. We don't have them. But, you know, we weren't that good. We tried putting the stuff in. We kicked the machine a couple times. It burped. The stuff came out. It wasn't working. So we tinkered with it. We put some more in. And, you know, we were only able to get a few batches to succeed. And, you know, after dealing with the Iraqis for 7 years, I believe them. They aren't that good. But because they lied to us, we can't give them the benefit of the doubt. We said, until you can document only 8,000 liters, we say you produced 80,000 liters. Now, notice where I'm getting that number. It's purely a hypothetical construct. There is no intelligence information that says they have this much. We just said that they had the potential to produce that much, which sounds fine and dandy until you realize that we blew up this factory in 1997. It no longer exists. And that liquid bulk anthrax, which is the kind produced by Iraq, has a shelf life of 3 years. Do they have any anthrax today? The same monitoring program that we had in place never detected any effort by Iraq to reconstitute a biological weapons program. I don't know. Nuclear weapons, the same problem. Ladies and gentlemen, what do we have? We have an Iraq that's been thoroughly investigated and disarmed to a 90-95% level. I can't give you a clean bill of health. There's still unaccounted for material, but some of the material that's unaccounted for are things like two missiles. We have the scraps, but because Iraq lied to us, we can't give them credit for it. Some of the unaccounted stuff is sarin and tabu nerve agent, but it has a shelf life of 5 years. It's no longer viable. Some of the unaccounted for material is anthrax, but again, has a shelf life of 3 years. It's not viable. Do they have weapons of mass destruction? The key question. So now we have to find out where that missing 5 to 10% is. We have to investigate. Now, I told you I'm not a chemist, a biologist, a nuclear physicist, or a rocket scientist, but you know, I did take fifth grade biology. I'm a dangerous guy. In fifth grade biology, I learned about the frog experiment, the nervous system of the frog, you know, where you poke it with a needle. They may not do that anymore, but when I went to elementary school, we still did that. You poke it and you see how the nervous system works. Well, we have to find the missing 5 to 10%. We don't know where it is. We don't know what it is. We just think it's out there. We assume that it's being held by Iraq, by the security forces of Saddam Hussein. We had intelligence information that from 1991 to 1993, material was being hidden by Saddam Hussein's bodyguard units. But, you know, there is no reference book on Saddam Hussein's bodyguard units. You know, pull out the master reference, open up to page 346. This is how Saddam's bodyguard units hide weapon of mass destruction. No, we don't know anything about Saddam's bodyguard. We just know they exist. So we have to investigate them. Well, how do we do that? Cause and effect. Cause and effect.